Our show's name pays tribute to the Boer Trekkers of South Africa, who in 1838 soundly defeated 30,000 Zulus on the bank of the Nkomo River, thereafter called Blood River, from the water turning red with the blood of the slain. Miraculously, no Boer Trekker died and only three were wounded. Now, your friend, Eddie Miller, will be your ambassador for tonight's show.
Dear Blood River Radio family, thank you so much for hanging out, and thank you for forgiving my boo-boo when you first came on a minute ago. I thought we were supposed to go hot, but my old ears fail sometimes. But anyway, I think we had a dynamite first and second hour, and I'll put this out there. I'm telling you flat out the truth. It's been a rough 2 weeks, health-wise, every other wise, and I didn't feel like I was that prepared that great, and I didn't really know who was going to be coming on for sure until... golly, late yesterday. Anyway, these two guys that came on, Jason and Kilroy, I thought they did a dynamite job. They really did. If what they did, I just threw a few questions in there, but the credit goes to them. They did a marvelous job. And thank God we have another superstar coming on. Matter of fact, we had the superstars, a fan of his, hanging on to talk to the superstar. Who is the superstar? He's that sword-destroying, the Yankee-killing, fearless, merciless hound of hell. That's what the Yankees say he is. The bitter ender, the sword wrecker himself. We had a fan to say hello to him. Anyway, yeah. Oh, Kilroy's always been a big fan of General Jeans. And that's true. I'm his fan, too. Hell, who isn't his fan? Gene is a second and third and fourth and fifth opinions of several people. He is a national treasure, and that's who we got going on right now. I don't care if he does destroy. He cost us a fortune in replacing these damn swords. But anyway, it comes out of his pay. How you doing, Bitter Ender?
Well, thank you so much for the introduction there, Cousin Eddie. I appreciate that.
Yes, sir. Yeah. Sir.
Somebody with an introduction like that, I'll run next door and see if I can find somebody that'll match up to your introduction there.
But just keeping me in mind for a steak dinner later on, cousin.
Can do that. We can do that. I tell you what, we were going to have this program back in April, and I got snowed under with so many things, Civil War show and SCV convention over in Humboldt, Tennessee Division. And then we were going to have the scouts camping out one weekend, and the rain took all that out. But I thought we could go back and pick up what was going to be one of our April programs. And that would be about General Forrest and the battle at Fort Pillow, Tennessee, on the Mississippi River, which occurred on April 12, 1864. And this is one of the controversial lies, propaganda, misinformation, bitter attacks that they always throw against Forrest. In fact, there are three of them. They say, number one, he started the Ku Klux Klan. We can't have statues of anybody that did that. Well, that's a lie. He didn't start the Ku Klux Klan. After the war, Forrest went back home to his home in Memphis to try and rebuild a life for himself, his wife, their children, his former slaves. They were free, but they had no place to go. Their homes had been destroyed by the Yankees. The farm implements had been destroyed. The crops had been destroyed. They were just homeless, pretty much scavengers living off the countryside. And then he also, what little they did have, he shared with the widows and orphans of soldiers that had served under him. So he was busy in Memphis after the war. The Ku Klux Klan was actually started in Pulaski, Tennessee, which is down south of Nashville, almost due south. Pulaski, Giles County is on the Alabama state line. And it was not started as a political organization. It was started as a soldiers organization, much like the American Legion of the VFW. And they get mad when I say that. I said, no, you're not listening. I said, the original Klan. And it was six former Confederate soldiers that started a club, and they used the name Kluklos, which is Greek for circle, and then it's K letters, then they put Klan, spelled it with a K at the end of it, and they would just dress up in these costumes and ride around at night and say they were ghosts from Shiloh or Chickamauga. And everybody knew it was a big joke, and they would always go by the girlfriend's house, and the girlfriend would pretend to be scared, and she would always faint. But she always fainted and fell into her boyfriend's arms. That's the way that was set up. And then, but then when the Reconstruction government got so bad and so many vultures descended on the South to pick the bones clean of anything that was left from the war, and they passed so many laws against white Southerners, they had to have vigilante groups to protect themselves from the attacks and the robbery and the thieving and protect the women of the South. And it wasn't just the Klan. It was the Red Shirts in South Carolina. It was the Knights of the White Camellia in Texas and Louisiana. So this just kind of a fun fraternity, comical organization turned into a political organization to protect the people of the South. So Forrest did not start it. There was a plaque on a law office in Pulaski with the names of the six former Confederate soldiers that started the Klan, and Forrest's name was not on it. And they said, well, he was head of it. No. There is a letter in the library at Cumberland University in Lebanon, Tennessee, addressed to Mrs. George Gordon, who was the wife of Confederate General George Gordon, who was head of the Klan. And they've got that. That's proof. But today's media and today's so-called court historians, they don't want to hear the facts. They've got their story made up, and that's the one they're sticking with. So, first, number one, head of the Klan. That's a lie. The second one they throw against him is the massacre of the poor Negro troops at Fort Pillow. And that's what we're going to talk about today. And then the third one they always throw against Forrest was that he was a slave dealer. Well, yes, he was. They got one out of three right. But slavery at that time was legal, and you could have been in a worse situation than to have been one of Mr. Forrest's slaves, because his slave quarters in Memphis always passed inspection by the Board of Health. He would not break up a family. In fact, he would try to buy back family members that had been separated. He was a businessman, and he knew that if he got a family back together, they were less likely to run off and lose money on them than if they were kept back all together. And there were certain people in the tri-state area of Tennessee, Mississippi, and Arkansas he wouldn't sell to, because he knew they weren't going to take care of them. So the war came along, and he told his slaves, if you will serve in our cavalry command as teamsters, blacksmiths, harness makers, carpenters, everything you did on the farm before the war, then at the end of the war, regardless of the outcome, if the South wins or loses, we'll give you your freedom. He guaranteed that. About the third time he'd been shot, he called them together and said, boys, I don't think I'm going to make it to the end of the war, but I promise Mrs. Forrest your freedom, and you're free to go now. But we really would appreciate it if you'd stick it out with us, because we need your help. And 44 out of the 45 stayed with him and finished out the war with him. And, of course, I've had the Forrest, quote, experts, the liberal nutcases, said, well, yeah, of course, they were surrounded by the Confederate Army. They couldn't go anywhere. Well, they don't know anything about Forrest. He spent more time behind Union lines on raids than he did behind the Confederate lines. So if his slaves wanted to get away, all they had to do was probably walk a half a mile down the road, and they'd be in the Federal Army camp. So these the lies from the communists, the censorship that they have, the Christian hating, the South hating, and the fake historians, they always throw these things against the South. And an easy target is Forrest, because they hate him so much. They couldn't defeat him on the battlefield. So what they've tried to do is defeat him in the arena of public opinion with lies and misinformation and propaganda. So Dr. Goebbels in Germany said, a lie told once is always a lie, but a lie told a thousand times becomes history. Yes. And so this is what has happened to the South after our failed attempt to win our independence in 1861 to 65, that we have been the villain of everything that's wrong with America today is because of the South, or evil white people, or exploiting the poor blacks, and so forth and so on. So it's just lies and propaganda. So for our listeners today, we're going to go into a little bit more detail and destroy one of their lives and talk about what actually happened at the battle at Fort Pillow in April of 1864. During the winter, that winter, Forrest and his command had been transferred away from Braxton Bragg and the Army of Tennessee. They were sent to the Department of Mississippi, Alabama, and Eastern Louisiana. And he spent that winter in Columbus, Mississippi. And he was working on reorganizing his cavalry command. Once again, his command had been taken away from him that he had raised, trained, recruited, and given to Joe Wheeler's cavalry. So he left Bragg's army with nothing but his personal staff and his escort company and some of his artillery. And then they were sent to Mississippi, where they spent the winter getting reorganized at Columbus, Mississippi. March the 1st.
See, we got to take a quick
break. And we will pick that up right after the break. So mount up, folks. We're getting ready to ride.
Yes, sir.
Looking for an IT partner that truly understands your needs? Managed IT Services is the answer. We meet with you regularly to discuss your goals and form a tailored technology plan. Our customers have called us a trusted advisor who delivers. When it comes to IT, we do it all. Firewalls, cloud storage, server migration, and more. Say goodbye to long-term contracts and hello to a team that earns your business month after month. Call 801-706-6980 now and let Managed IT Services transform your IT experience.
I'm Pastor Everett Ramsey, pastor of Faith Baptist Church. A congregation of God's covenant people, informed Christians know that we are at the brink of a long-planned one-world government being executed that will not tolerate true Christian faith. There is a way to stop it. Our church has used God's spiritual weapons of warfare many times over the years, and in every case that was properly executed, the Church of Jesus Christ has been delivered. It is called the Court of Divine Justice. David used it many times. Read Psalm 37, Psalm 109. It includes truthful information, repentance, and imprecatory prayers. Blood River Radio is the only radio station I know that supports action based on truth about lies concerning the Confederacy, the Civil Rights Movement, the German people, the true Holocaust, and who the true covenant people of God are, and the sins and failures of the churches, if any of these. This means anything to you, and it should, then please say so with your money, as well as prayers. You may obtain information from us about the Courts of Divine Justice by sending your offering and request to Blood River Radio, and we take none of the money.
Have you ever had great honey? No, I mean really good, all-natural, raw honey? Well, now you can, thanks to localhoneyman.com. We can ship out our locally made honey all across the U.S. So don't worry, you won't miss out. Plus, Local Honeyman has so many different flavors, like Utah Wildflower, High Desert Delight, Happy Valley, and Blackberry, just to name a few. So purchase your delicious raw honey today at localhoneyman.com.
In the morning. Smells like victory. Some
folks are born, dear Blood River Radio family, thank you so much for calling in. We had some great conversations during the break, but we're going back to the Bitter Ender himself. You know, he's right. The Bitter Ender is a national treasure to Southern people, is white people everywhere. To instill pride and confidence in you being white. And he also combats the lives of these Yankee Jewish lives against Southern white people. Who else would do it if Gene didn't do it on Blood River Radio? Back to you, Gene.
All right. Well, we were talking about getting ready to go, and I hope everybody's mounted up on their horse and got 3 weeks'
yes.
supplies and ammunition ready to go. We're headed for a raid into Tennessee,
all
coming
right.
out of Columbus, Mississippi. This was Forrest's second raid into West Tennessee. His first one was in December of 1862. And it was so successful, he took out the Mobile and Ohio Railroad, destroyed it, and that was Grant's main supply line. Grant was going to come down from Memphis down through the central part of Mississippi and take Vicksburg from the land side, from the east, or from the backside of Vicksburg. And when Forrest destroyed his railroad supply line and Earl Van Dorn destroyed Grant's supply depot at Holly Springs, Mississippi, Grant had to turn around and go back to Memphis and wait for a fleet to be built in the Federal Navy to protect him and come down the Mississippi River and attack Vicksburg from the Mississippi. Forrest knew how to take out larger armies. And Forrest was very smart. He understood that the South could not win a conventional war of fighting these big monster battles. Yes, they won a lot of battles in Virginia, But they never could destroy the Army of the Potomac and threaten Washington, D.C. So it was a war of attrition, and we could not replace our losses. And the longer the war went on, the less chance the South had of winning the war. Because the Yankee Army, they could recruit, the draft came into effect, or they called it the conscript law back then. They were bringing boatloads of Germans and Irish over here to fight in the Yankee Army. We could not replace the losses. So we could not fight these huge conventional battles like Gettysburg or Sharpsburg or in fact, Chickamauga. I mean, Confederates won, but they took 18,000 casualties at Chickamauga. Damn. They killed, wounded, missing in action. And so, you know, yeah, they won, but they couldn't replace those losses. So the Army of Tennessee was pretty much crippled after that and fighting defensive battles all the way down toward the end of the war. So far as understood, you have to go behind the enemy and take out their supply lines. And once you do that, they're stuck and they can't advance. They don't have the food for the men or the horses. You remember an army of 50,000 has probably got 10 or 12,000 horses and mules to pull all their supplies and artillery. So they can't move. And that's what Forrest was good at. And he understood that. And he knew that, you know, these huge battles that the South might win, in the long run, it was a doomed strategy. But Richmond and the Confederate government, they kept thinking that one big victory in Virginia or in Maryland or even in Pennsylvania, that was the whole point of going up into Pennsylvania, was to bring the war to the North. One big victory there and threaten Washington, D.C., and the war would be over. And the Confederates won a lot of battles, but they could never destroy the Union Army of the Potomac and threaten D.C. to bring the war to an end. So we're back to Columbus, Mississippi in the winter and spring of 1864. Forrest has been given the cavalry command, a division of James Chalmers and Abraham Buford, and Buford's men had no horses. They'd either died or been worn out. They were dismounted cavalry, which meant they traveled on foot. So Forrest was going to go on a raid into West Tennessee and Western Kentucky to get horses, and they left Columbus, Mississippi on March the 1st. The operational orders that they had never mentioned Fort Pillow. That was not on their agenda. They were going after horses. They came out of Columbus by the 20th of March. They were up at Jackson, Tennessee. He left part of his command there to take care of the horses they had captured and prisoners. And he sent Lieutenant Colonel Crew's battalion down toward Memphis to fake an attack on Memphis and hold the federal troops in Memphis. Because Forrest didn't want this huge command coming out behind him and being trapped in Tennessee. And he picked Lieutenant Colonel Crew's command because most of them were from Memphis and Shelby County. And they had friends there, and they knew where to go if they needed horses or supplies or whatever. And they put on such a big show around Memphis that Union General Holbert, not only did he not come out after Forrest, he thought Memphis was under attack by Forrest's whole command. And you got to give Crews credit. Boy, he put on a show down there. And Holbert was begging for reinforcements to be sent up from Vicksburg. So Forrest is up, coming out of Jackson. They come up to Union City, and the federal garrison there, they sent in, surrounded it, and sent in a demand for surrender under Forrest's name. It was two colonels under his command, and one of them was Colonel Faulkner. And Colonel Faulkner had a pretty famous grandson as an author, William Faulkner. And Rutherford, Colonel Rutherford was the other one. And the garrison of over 6,000, the garrison at Union City surrendered, and reinforcements were only 6 miles away by the time they got them surrendered and got them out of there. So you never hear about the massacre at Union City because that garrison surrendered. Then part of Buford's division went on up into Kentucky, past Mayfield, and up to Paducah. They attacked Paducah. They got horses there. He came back to Mayfield and gave his men about a week off to go home, recruit, get supplies. And on the date they were supposed to come back to Mayfield, every single one of them came back. Not only that, but they brought friends and relatives with them because they wanted to ride with Forrest. So now they're coming back into Tennessee. They're back at Trenton, Tennessee, and on April the 4th, Forrest sends a letter to his commanding officer in Mississippi, Stephen D. Lee, telling him about how many prisoners they'd captured, how many miles of railroad track they'd torn up, telegraph lines they'd taken out, horses they'd captured, Buford's entire division was now remounted on the best horses that the Yankee government could supply and equipment and everything they needed. Forrest highly recommended the United States Army Quartermaster Department. He said, boy, they are great. They keep bringing supplies down here, and we'll never run short of supplies as long as the Yankees keep invading the South. So this was April the 4th. They'd gone from March the 1st to April the 4th, and Fort Pillow had never been mentioned. And on April the 6th, he sent a supplementary order to General Stephen Lee and said, we will attend to Fort Pillow. Oh, so that's your birthday. Well, that was a good day. That's why it's an important date on the Confederate calendar.
Why, hell yes.
Now, why did they change from a cavalry raid deep into enemy country, way behind enemy lines, and they had what they needed for horses, and they're coming out of Tennessee? Why did they change and decide to go 60 miles over to the west and attack a fort on the Mississippi River? And everybody knows that cavalry can't attack a fort. You need siege guns and all this other stuff like that. And even if they captured it, the Federal Navy could come up the Mississippi River and just blast them out of the fort. So why would they go on a crazy harebrained scheme like this? It's because of the civilians in West Tennessee. The Federal Army had occupied Fort Pillow that was actually built by the Confederates early in the war and named for Gideon Pillow, who was the Confederate militia commander of Tennessee forces at the early part of the war. And it had been abandoned by the Confederates, but it still kept the name Fort Pillow from a Confederate general. But the Yankee troops that were there had been coming out of the fort and robbing and looting the homes in West Tennessee and attacking the civilians and raping the women. And that's one thing you didn't do. Forrest could fight soldiers, but when you attack the women, that was carrying it too far. So he sent General Chalmers' division headed west to go over and take out the federal garrison at Fort Pillow. And they were brutal people there. One of the people that they had in command there in West Tennessee was a James Brownlow. And he was the son of that Parson Brownlow that was the Reconstruction governor of Tennessee after the war. He had a rule that any Confederates captured in West Tennessee were just shot on site. If they were coming home, trying to sneak home and see their family or something, they got caught in West Tennessee, they'd shoot them. They weren't treated as prisoners of war. Of course, the news nerds and the so-called court historians that write all their blasphemous propaganda about the South, they don't tell you all this. The worst one, though, that they were going after was Fielding Hurst. And he would charge people a tax to live in West Tennessee under the federal command. It's kind of like the Muslim tax. Now, if you don't convert to Mohammed and Islam, you have to pay a tax in a lot of these countries. And he would murder and torture any Southern sympathizer, Confederate soldier that was caught in West Tennessee. Of course, they don't tell you that fact. They don't tell you why he went there. The news nerds and the fake historians of propaganda said, well, he just went there because there were blacks at Fort Pillow. Fort Pillow had about 557 troops in it, and about half white, half black. And most of them were what they call Tennessee Tories. They were Tennesseans that had either deserted the Confederate Army or joined the Federal Army from Tennessee. And a lot of them were taking out revenge on their neighbors in West Tennessee and stealing and robbing from people that had they had a feud with them before the war. This was a great chance to get even. And they'd run out and grab whatever they could or attack the women and then run back and hide under the Yankee flag at Fort Pillow. And so it was the civilians that asked Forrest to do something about Fort Pillow. Had no military significance at all. They were on a raid. They got the horses. They were coming out of West Tennessee. He sent Chalmers over there. General Chalmers' men, Robert McCullough's Missouri Cavalry, overran the pickets at dawn on April 12th. They had no clue that there were any Confederates within 100 miles of Fort Pillow, and they were caught completely off guard. The Confederates, and you have to understand the topography there. Fort Pillow was built down on a bluff right on the Mississippi River. And we will get into that a little bit more after the break and tell you why topography dictated what happened in the battle.
That's a sight to behold. We were there one time, me and Gene, and TPC.
Yes, sir.
Be right back, folks.
Exposing corruption, informing citizens, pursuing liberty. You're listening to Liberty News Radio.
News this hour from townhall.com. I'm Jason Walker. Few details emerging as yet out of Palm Springs, California today, where a large explosion has badly damaged the fertility clinic and a few other businesses. There have been no reports of any fatalities in that blast and no word on the cause. Major jailbreak.
Authorities say 10 men escaped a New Orleans prison Friday by going through a hole behind a toilet and scaling a wall while the one guard on duty was away getting food. Surveillance footage shows the escapees sprinting out of the facility, some wearing orange clothing, others in white. They scaled a barbed wire fence, covering it with blankets to avoid being cut. One prisoner was caught soon after the escape, after a brief chase on foot through the famous French Quarter. Two more escapees were caught by Friday evening. I'm Donna Warder.
President Trump says he will speak by phone Monday with Russian President Vladimir Putin about ending the war in Ukraine. Mr. Trump will later then talk with Ukraine's president and a number of NATO allies. Also at townhall.com, President Trump says he was struck by the wealth on display during his visit to several Arab states this past week. Here's Greg Clugston.
Throughout his four-day tour, the president repeatedly commented on the lavish surroundings of the oil-rich autocrats. He admired the marble in the Qatari palace, praised the gleaming skyline in Saudi Arabia, and boasted about the red carpet welcome he received. The president also grumbled about the much less impressive Air Force One compared with the aircraft belonging to his Arab hosts. The trip focused mainly on business deals boosting U.S. investment. Greg Clugston, Washington.
The death count from the overnight tornadoes has risen once again, now at least 27 dead in three states. More on these stories, townhall.com.
Hi, this is Rhett Rasmussen of besthotgrill.com. Gift giving occurs year-round, whether for birthdays, holidays, or a special expression of thanks to your best clients and customers. Of course you want to show your love and gratitude, but you also want to give a gift that provides a positive image of you and your organization. Solaire infrared grills from besthotgrill.com are both practical and unforgettable. Made in the USA, Solaire has a grill for most budgets, but more importantly, Solaire delivers the wow that everybody likes to receive in a gift. Impressive out of the box, and even more so in use, the Solaire infrared grills are the gift of value that will build relationships. With every great tasting, juicy meal enjoyed from their Solaire, they'll think of you. Step up your gift giving. Learn more about the amazing Solaire infrared grills at besthotgrill.com. That's besthotgrill.com. Besthotgrill.com.
I'm Monica Schaefer from Canada, a former political prisoner. Here at Blood River Radio, we are not afraid to tell the truth and shame the devil. Our mission is to fight against white genocide. We do that by exposing the lies. We talk about the American Civil War. We talk about the vilification of German people and by extension, all white people. And we even talk about that linchpin lie, the Holocaust. Deception by the alien enemy within has brought us whites to our knees. My last words at the Schaefer's speech crime trial in Germany were, quote, "If there was a law forbidding us to breathe, we would break that law immediately just to live. And so it is with this law. We must break this law in order to survive and thrive as a people," unquote. Please donate to Blood River Radio and help keep us on the air.
Do you treasure your liberty? Well, at LovingLiberty.net, we most certainly do. And we want to help protect your liberty, too. Become part of the family. Everyone knows that the core of any society is the family. Therefore, the government should foster and protect the integrity of its family, we the people. Won't you join us as a Loving Liberty sponsor to help us promote the principles in the 5,000-year leap? Let's restore the miracle that changed the world at LovingLiberty.net.
As you are aware, America is divided over every fault line possible. This is intentionally fostered by those who do not love God, family, or country. We believe a peaceful future as a free people absolutely depends on civility. Clarion Call for Civility is looking for funding and volunteers at every level to make our hopes and efforts a reality. Please donate, sign our pledge, and help us in our sacred cause. Please visit callforcivility.com for more details. callforcivility.com.
Dear Blood River Radio family,
I would just like to tell them to bitter end during the break. I only take a second to remind you, next week, God willing, everything goes good with the old surgery and everything, we're going to start our German history course on first hour. It's going to fully complement the Bitter Ender's Confederate history hour. Also, the Bitter Ender has agreed to come on and co-host the people we have coming on. Paul Fromm's kind of in charge of it. But he's bringing on German expatriates to talk about German history. And the Bitter Ender knows a thing or two. You know, he's a history teacher. He's agreed to come on and kind of sit in with those people on some of our programs. But anyway,
well,
be looking forward to that.
Honor to be on with Paul Fromm. That would be an honor to be with him and all he's had to go through in Canada while they've threatened to arrest him and do everything. And that's the thing about these liberals. They cannot stand people telling the truth. And they threaten to arrest you, like David Irvin in Europe, and ban people from coming into Germany or Austria if they tell the truth. They've been so brainwashed and so controlled by the U.S. axis of evil empire all over the world, they don't dare step out of line and anger the imperial empire in Washington, D.C. And I feel sorry for the German people that they have to live under the lie that they're having forced on them by our rotten government in the United States. So anyway, it'll be an honor to be on a program with Paul Fromm, that's for sure. And Monica, I hope Monica's going to be on there too. So that's a very brave lady right there.
We're gonna get Monica's brother Alfred to come on. The first guest up, and he was a prisoner too. And I'll make this brief. The first guest is gonna be, I think he's in his about 90s. He was run out of Germany. I guess like Monica's family, Monica's dad was in the German army and he suffered. He was captured and put in one of Eisenhower's death camps, but he survived. But we're having a German expatriate to come on. I guess he was just baby when they, but he survived it. He's going to come out in the first hour because he's lived German history. And I'm sure the Bitter Ender will be on with people like that. But I'm looking forward to that coming on, Bitter Ender. I know.
Okay,
I
thank know you. That'd be an honor.
Yes, sir.
Well, back
but
to our history lesson today. We were talking about the lies about Fort Pillow and the massacre at Fort Pillow. So we talked about Forrest coming into West Tennessee and Western Kentucky to get horses and coming out of the state, heading back to Mississippi. And the civilians in West Tennessee asked him to do something about the war criminals coming out of Fort Pillow and attacking the civilian population in West Tennessee and the murders that they were committing against Confederate prisoners of war. They weren't treating them as prisoners of war. They just shot them and killed them if they were Confederate soldiers that were caught in West Tennessee. So on the dawn of April the 12th, Colonel McCullough's Missouri Cavalry overran the pickets at Fort Pillow. And then the Confederates took a ridge that was higher than the fort itself. Now, Fort Pillow, as we were talking before the break, is built down on a bluff to try to defend the Mississippi River against the Federal Navy coming down from Cairo, Illinois, or up through there. But it never had enough heavy artillery to defeat the Federal Navy. And then once Grant took Pittsburgh Landing, you had a huge Federal Army behind them. So the river forts had to be abandoned. And now the federal soldiers occupied Fort Pillow for the next couple of years, and they were using it as their base of operation to rob and rape the people of West Tennessee. And they were the ones that asked Forrest to do something about the fort. So the fort itself was down on a bluff over the river, but there's a ridge that's sort of semicircular, big curve around the fort that's actually higher than the fort itself. So once the Confederates took that ridge, now they're firing about 50 or 60 yards down into the fort. So anybody that raised their head above the earthen wall of this fort was immediately shot. And they shot Booth, who was the commanding officer there, he was one of the first casualties. The Confederate snipers picked him off. I mean, he took a bullet right between his running lights. He was gone. He was the only officer that had any combat experience there. The command then fell to the second in command, a Major Bradford, that even the federal officer said was worthless, had no military experience at all. He pulled some financial shenanigans up in Iowa or somewhere up there, ducked out of town with the sheriff and the loan officers on his heels, and joined the Yankee Army to get away from being caught and put in jail up there. A good person to have in command when you're in a combat situation.
Yes.
So now the Confederates, so by 8 o'clock that morning, the battle was pretty much over. The Confederates controlled the high ground. Forrest got there about 10 that morning, but they were working, the Confederates were working their way into that. Any time the Federals tried to roll cannons into these openings, but between this earthen wall, the embrasures, they called them, where they'd fire the cannons, the Confederate snipers would pick off the gunners that were trying to fire the cannons. So the artillery, there were six pieces of artillery they had there, they were rendered useless by the Confederate snipers, because every time they tried to fire one of them, when they rolled the cannon up to the opening to fire it, they'd lose all their cannoneers. And three times, Forrest sent in a white flag of truce and demanded the surrender of the fort. And the third time, it was sent in at 3 o'clock in the afternoon. See, there's how Forrest planned and worked on it. He kept working his soldiers in closer and closer. When he got there in the morning, they didn't just say, okay, everybody, let's rush in there and see if we can overrun it. No, he made sure that his troops were in covered positions to the south of the fort, to the north of the fort, and Coal Creek Ravine was an area up there, and then up on this bluff. So he made sure his men were in a perfect position to attack that fort if they had to. But he was trying to give them a chance to surrender and get out of an untenable position and a suicide position. Obviously, they'd never studied Texas history and being trapped in the Alamo, so they didn't know what was going to happen to somebody trapped in a fort. Yeah, they missed that lesson. So they sent in one more request or demand for surrender at 3 o'clock in the afternoon. And what had happened, the white Yankee officers didn't think that the black soldiers were going to fight because they'd never been under fire in combat. So they gave them whiskey to get them drunked up and build up their courage. And the Confederates found this after they got over the wall into the fort. They found barrels of whiskey around the wall of the fort with gourds they were using for dippers. And during this truce, the blacks were up on the wall of the fort hollering and all these obscenities and making these obscene gestures and everything at the Confederates while this truce was going on, which was not a really smart idea.
No.
This was in the days before the NFL and the NBA, and trash talk did not go over well back then. To paraphrase Dean Wormer in the movie Animal House, black, drunk, and stupid is no way to go through life, son. So they made a bad situation worse because the Confederates are already hot about what they had done to their relatives in West Tennessee and the attacks against the civilians. And then they come out, the blacks start doing all of this, jumping and jiving and shouting all sorts of insults. That just made a bad situation a lot worse. So the Major Bradford, the Yankee commander, refuses the offer to surrender. And he wanted an hour to discuss it with his officers. Forrest said, you got 20 minutes, because they knew they were sending steamboats or reinforcements up the Mississippi River from Memphis, and he wasn't going to wait around all afternoon until the reinforcements got there. He said, you got 20 minutes. And so 3:30, he sends the word back, we will not surrender. And so Forrest says, well, that's your call. At 4 o'clock, the Confederates made this charge. They came down off of this ridge. They jumped into a moat right around the fort. Now the Yankees couldn't get up on the wall of this fort and shoot down into the moat. So here you have the Confederates and the Yankees. They're about 8 feet apart, but neither one of them can shoot at the other one because as soon as they raise their head, they're going to be picked off. And the Confederate snipers were still up on this ridge. They were shooting over the heads of their men that were down in this moat and picking off any of the Yankees that tried to crawl out on this earthen wall of the fort and shoot down at the Confederates. Good thing they didn't have hand grenades. They could just pitch them over the wall there.
Yes.
So on the second bugle blast, the Confederates came up out of this moat and they didn't stand up and shoot. They flopped down on this wall, and the first thing the Yankees saw were the business end barrels of double barrel shotguns, rifles, and pistols firing right into their faces. I mean, like from 3 or 4 feet away. And this was the original shock and awe. And they broke, the federal defenders of the fort broke and ran towards the bluff. They had a plan that if the fort were overrun, they're going to come down this bluff below the level of the fort, and a Yankee gunboat was going to fire a canister at the Confederates up on top of the bluff. Well, the gunboat had been driven off by Forrest men. Same thing as the cannons. When they opened those firing ports on the side of the gunboat, the Confederates just delivered a huge volume of rifle fire in there. So they had bullets ricocheting off the barrels of these cannons on the gunboat and killing the gunners. They closed up and steamed off upriver and got out of there. They were never part of the battle. The new era was the gunboat. So now the federal defenders broke and ran across this open parade ground to try to get to that down below that bluff and ran through all of these tents that were set up out there. Oh, they had the black soldiers in tents on the parade ground inside the fort. The white soldiers had cabins outside the fort. The white Yankees didn't want to integrate with the blacks, so they didn't have anything to do with them.
But at least you gotta say that good about them.
Started running between these rows of tents. Well, it just compacted everybody into a mass. So the Confederates from 30 yards away.
We got to take our last break, Gene.
We'll come back and finish
Bypass the mainstream narrative with Liberty News Radio at libertynewsradio.com. Engage with charismatic hosts live or on demand. We cover the crucial news focused on God, family, and country. News that other networks simply refuse to use. Think of LNR's hard-hitting news and podcasts at your fingertips anytime, anywhere. Join us at libertynewsradio.com. Empower your day with the truth. Because the truth will set you free. LibertyNewsRadio.com.
I'm Michael Hill, president of the League of the South. I and my compatriots are Southern nationalists. We seek the survival, well-being, and independence of the Southern people, our people. The League wants a South that enjoys the sweet fruits of Christian liberty and prosperity, but our current situation won't allow it. We must have our independence from Washington, D.C. and the globalists. The present system cannot be reformed. Without independence, we will continue down this path of destruction. To us, this is not acceptable. I'm asking you, Southern man and woman, to join us today to free the South. Call us at 256-757-6789 or see our website at www.leagueofthesouth.com. God save the South.
Introducing Managed IT Services from NPI. We offer top-notch data backup and recovery, email spam protection, and network security tailored to your needs and budget. With 20-plus years of experience in the medical field, our HIPAA-certified consultants know what it takes to protect sensitive information. Don't settle for less. Give us a call at 801-706-6980 and experience the difference with Managed IT Services. Remember, your IT support should be fast, efficient, and reliable.
Being this is a .44 Magnum, the most powerful handgun in the world, and would blow your head clean off, you've got to ask yourself one question. Do I feel lucky? Well, do you, punk?
Dear Blood Rule Radio family, I'm not going to waste any more time. I'm probably, if you're enjoying this history lesson more than I am, you're really, really doing something. Anyway, go ahead, Bitter Ender.
So, this is late in the afternoon of April 12th. The Confederates had come over the earthen wall at Fort Pillow. The shock and awe that the Yankees got all these rifles and pistols. And here's what Forrest men would do. They would carry a rifle or they'd carry a shotgun, but they would carry at least four pistols with them. They would have two in a pistol belt, and they would have two across the pommel of the saddle. And so when they came over that wall and flopped down on top of it, it was almost like machine guns going off in the face of the Yankee defenders. They got the blast from the shotgun or the rifle, and they dropped the Confederates would drop the rifle, whip out two pistols, they'd blast out 12 rounds there, lay them down, whip out two more pistols, and start blasting away. So the federal soldiers broke and ran, but they got running between these rows of tents, so they were compacted in there. And the Confederates from 30 or 40 yards away, they were firing into this blue mass. They couldn't miss. And so they just started piling up the bodies in between these tents. And most of the casualties that the federal soldiers, the Yankee soldiers, suffered were up on the parade ground up on top of the bluff. Now, a lot of them jumped or fell down this bluff, and a lot of them broke their leg or broke their back coming down this bluff. Now you had the Confederates that were attacking from the north coming down the river road to the south. You had the Confederates on the south side of the fort that were attacking going north, coming up the river road from the south and headed north. And then you had the Confederates that came over the earthen wall of the fort. They're up on top of the bluff, so the Yankees are not caught in just a crossfire. They're caught in a triple fire. And a lot of them, now this is where the controversy comes in. Most historians agree that this is what happened up to this point. And so a lot of the Yankee soldiers were surrendering and throwing down their weapons. A lot of the blacks that were drunked up on whiskey kept fighting, or they would surrender and they'd throw their weapon down. The Confederates would throw them out of the way so they could go after the ones that were still shooting. And a lot of these blacks would pick up the rifle and start shooting the Confederates in the back. And they would turn around, and that was it. If they'd pull that, then they'd just finish them off right there.
Yes.
And I'm sure, I would not sit here and tell you for a fact that there weren't some of the Yankee soldiers that were shot after they surrendered. But there was a lot of bad blood between the Confederates and the Yankees. And so there were probably a lot of individuals that took out revenge on these Yankee soldiers, black and white, that had attacked their family in West Tennessee. Forrest gets into the fort about 20 minutes after the initial attack goes over the wall. He orders the U.S. flag to be cut down because as long as the flag was flying, that was saying that the fort hadn't surrendered. The flag was cut down. Most of the fighting stopped by that time. The prisoners were being taken out of there. One of the claims that they throw against Forrest is that Confederates buried Union soldiers alive, and that was a lie. Because the Confederate officer in charge of the prisoners said, we ordered their prisoners to bury their dead. And that's what you usually did in these battles. The prisoners had to bury their own dead soldiers, so they couldn't claim, well, the enemy buried these wounded soldiers alive. So they took care of that. They rounded up the prisoners that could be moved. There were 130 wounded Yankees that were wounded too seriously to be moved. The Confederates left them there at the fort that night with the Yankee medical staff to take care of their wounded prisoners. They took out 201 prisoners that were either slightly wounded or not wounded at all. They took them out as prisoners, and there were 226 that were actually killed during the battle. Now, a massacre, in the definition in the dictionary, is a total annihilation, no survivors. Like Custer at Little Bighorn.
Yeah.
So if they took out 200 prisoners and they left 130 seriously wounded behind, how could the Northern press call that a massacre? Well, they did anyway. They needed some kind of propaganda situation to prop up the war morale in the Northern states. This was the spring of 1864. Grant had gone east to fight against Lee, but there was no guarantee that Grant would do any better than Irwin McDowell or fighting Joe Hooker or Ambrose P. Burnside. They're all just footnotes in history. And Sherman was going against Joe Johnston, and Sherman was coming out of Chattanooga in the spring and summer of 1864, was headed for Atlanta, but there was no guarantee that Sherman was going to do anything. He'd been a miserable disaster in independent command. He did okay while Grant was in charge, and he was under Grant's command, but on his own, he didn't do well at all. And this is 1864, and these Confederate commerce raiders, these ships, were ripping and roaring over every ocean in the world. By 1864, no foreign country would ship a cargo on a U.S. ship because they knew that these commerce raiders, like the Alabama, the Shenandoah, the Florida, the Nashville, they were out there attacking anything with a Yankee flag on it. And remember, in the spring of the summer of 1863, they had draft rights all over the North when the draft was initiated. And you could get out of the draft if you paid $300, which would be about $8,000 today. Well, what poor person has $8,000 to get out of military service?
Not me.
So the poor were having to fight the war while the rich Yankees could buy their way out of it. So that's why they had the draft rights. And the biggest one, of course, was in New York City. If you ever saw that movie, Gangs of New York, that portrayed what happened at those draft rights in New York. And the draft riders went after the blacks in New York. And there's no telling how many blacks were murdered in New York and hung from light posts in New York
City. Not in New York City.
Oh, sure. No. This is not Richmond or Charleston or Mobile. This is New York City. And then their bodies were set on fire after they hung them from the lamppost in New York. Really nice people up there.
Yes.
So anyway, they needed something for propaganda. And so they created this myth or this lie, this story. And fake news is not a recent phenomenon. There was fake news back in 1864. Yeah. So they came up, fake news came up with the Fort Pillow Massacre. And they ran this to newspapers all over the North. And they ran editorials and blaming Forrest and blaming the Southerners for massacring the poor Negro troops in Fort Pillow. And I'm sure if you're in a combat situation and all this shooting is going on around you, you sit there and go, okay, I'm not going to shoot that guy with the gun because he's a white guy. Now, here's a black guy over here, and I let the white guy shoot at me, but I'm going to shoot the black guy. So, yeah, I'm sure that happened a lot. So the Confederates in this melee along this river road and below the bluff, they were shooting anything that had a rifle in their hands that was firing at them. So you can see from the factual information that the Fort Pillow Massacre was a fake news lie, and it was used for propaganda. And they used the race incident or the race of it to, you know, incite hatred and animosity toward the South. I've always said that Nathan Bedford Forrest was the first victim of a racial hoax in this country. And now with George Floyd and the Twana Brawley in New York and the Duke lacrosse team and all the other racial hoaxes we've had that found out they were lies, and the newspapers and the TV and the media portrayed it as horrible, horrible white people. And then after they found out it's a lie, they dropped that subject, went on to something else. You know, telling us what a great President Biden was being, what great health he was in. You know, they dropped that subject as soon as it was shown that it was a lie. But there was nobody that could refute this Fort Pillow Massacre lie, because by the time the information got to the Southern people about what actually happened there, it was too late. It was already, Forrest got back to Mississippi, gave his report, final report of what happened. Well, the Yankee newspapers, they weren't going to print the Southern side of the story of what actually happened. They had their Fort Pillow Massacre story, and they were sticking with it. And they were going to keep pummeling the people over the head with this throughout the war, and they still do today. They still lie about it. And I've heard this on national television, and when they want to attack Forrest or they want to attack Southerners, they always throw out this garbage about the Fort Pillow Massacre, which was a propaganda lie. That's all it was. So for our listeners, if you hear somebody throw that at you, just say, well, it wasn't a massacre. He took out over 200 prisoners and left another 130 behind that were too seriously wounded. A massacre is a total annihilation. So what happened to all those people that were left behind or were treated as prisoners of war? So the Fort Pillow Massacre is a lie right there. And then I always say, and why did Forrest go to Fort Pillow? He was on a raid into West Tennessee behind enemy lines. They needed horses. They got the horses they needed. They were headed out of the state of Tennessee back to Mississippi. Why did he go 60 miles out of his way to attack a fort? Because of the civilians. So why don't you defend the war criminals that were coming out of Fort Pillow and attacking the civilians, and especially the women, in West Tennessee? So instead of us having to defend, why don't you throw it off on our South-hating critics and say, how about you defending the war criminals that were hiding under the U.S. flag and coming out to attack the civilians in West Tennessee? How are you going to defend that? How do you defend murdering disarmed prisoners of war? Let's see you defend that. That's why Forrest went to Fort Pillow. It's what you people were doing is the only reason he went there. So hopefully that will give our listeners some ammunition.
They'll never come on and debate with somebody like you. I invited that clown several times who works at a big news station there in Nashville, the guy that made Jared Taylor look like an ass. I invited him to come on and debate with us. No way, Jose. I've invited him over and over. I'm calling him a coward and everything else. It's the coward son of a bitch won't come on the radio. They would bring you on their place, but they won't come on with an even playing field like we got here. Gene, no, thank you so much, buddy. I tell you one damn thing. We tell the truth here. Thanks to you, we tell the truth to the people, to the white people, so they can take pride in themselves and not believe all these damn lies. But thank you so much, Gene. You are a national treasure, brother. God bless you. I salute you, brother. And I know,
thank Daddy. We just want to try to help defend the South.
Well, you're a treasure to our people to listen to Blood River Radio. I know that. People, we've got another one in the history books. The same time, same place next week. Be here at the 24th. We'll see you. Thank you, Gene. Thank you, Miss Lizzie. All right, everybody. Thank you, Blood River Radio family.